I'm Christopher Lydon with the freelance global adventurer, noticer, and scorekeeper Parag Khanna. My question, extending the title of Parag's new book, is How to Run the World After Egypt. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Parag, we'll get to the new book, but pick up from your first one 3 years ago that blew me away. The takeaway lesson of the second world was that the aspiring world out there didn't have to get free, prosperous, or modern the American way. There were also the Chinese route and the European Union route to finance and technology and global inclusion. That was 4 years ago, late George W. Bush time. What has changed in what is still early Obama time?
Well, Chris, to be honest, I could have published that article and that book today, and I wouldn't have changed a single word. Let's look at the Chinese trajectory, which obviously has earned ever more respect before, during, and now after the financial crisis. Let's look at the stalemate with Iran. Let's look at the phrase, Egypt is ripe for revolution, which was right there on page 180, whatever. Let's look at the rise of Brazil. Let's look at the way in which the China-India dynamic still plays very much in China's favor. Let's look at Russia basically being dropped from the Goldman Sachs BRIC category. And as you know, I had a couple of scathing chapters about Russia in there.
Losing population, money, everything.
Yeah, and it's not about who made predictions about XYZ, who said Musharraf was a terrible autocrat and we should have gotten rid of him and who didn't. That's not really what it's about. The systemic trends that one can easily locate by way of traveling and seeing things on the ground have proven true because they aren't sudden. These are continuous processes always unfolding. The role of oil wealth and sovereign wealth funds, the rise of the state capitalist model, all of these are meta trends that have been really unfolding for a long time. And all I did was take a snapshot of it. And therefore, it's not surprising that it's still true 4 years later.
Let's talk about how to run the world after Egypt. Your book is about a new diplomacy, all this asymmetrical networking of not just states, but NGOs and Davos and banks and cities, which you say are the new world. How is all of that different wiring rewired after Egypt? How much has changed in Tahrir Square?
Well, this book takes into account everything that has just happened in Tahrir Square, because I explicitly say that the Generation Y, those who are under the age of 25 or 20 today, are getting their hands on smartphones and social media in ways that make autocrats more nervous than economic sanctions do. That's right from the introduction of the book. I have spent time in Alexandria with young Arab bloggers and activists who have been plotting exactly these kinds of activities. I've seen them do it. I've seen them exchange information. I very much felt this was coming, even without knowing it was coming, because this generation that has known nothing but Mubarak and Mubarakism around the region was destined to eventually revolt. And the spark was the WikiLeaks cable about Tunisia. But the fuel was obviously years, decades of economic disenfranchisement. And now the fuse, I mean, the way in which this has spread so quickly obviously is amplified by technology and social media. It's a perfect storm, a wicked brew. It just has come together very quickly. And I'm very overjoyed about it, quite frankly.
It's not the most important thing about Egypt, but it's fascinating to me for Americans to see what we think of as Steve Jobs' inventions working for other people, maybe better than they work for us. But we've got to talk about the power of Al Jazeera, which the Americans don't enjoy, but has become, you know, the newspaper of record in the sense of these events. We've got to talk about technology working in a sense for everybody else. It's the other guys who have, in a certain sense, seized the Steve Jobs moment.
You know, technology underpins globalization to some degree, and globalization has ceased to become synonymous with Americanization. And technology is a big part of that. Once other powers, states, non-state, whomever, get their hands on communications technology and so forth, they're able to run with it, to do their own thing, to compete, to contest, to challenge, to run their own lives. And that's precisely what's happening. The means have been given, the means have spread, and people will use those means for whatever end they choose. And so that is the deeper subtext of what is happening around the world.
I'm fascinated that President Erdogan of Turkey, a friendly but slightly suspect figure on the official listings, is now suddenly the man that people want to talk to and look to. In the broker's role that might have been ours, is this a good thing, bad thing? Did it have to happen that way?
Now we've seen it in two instances. The first is with respect to Iran, where Brazil and Turkey stepped up, but primarily Turkey.
And Tom Friedman and Hillary Clinton went ballistic.
Right, because they felt that someone was stepping on their turf. But the fact is, if what you represent is stasis, stalemate, and 30 years of bad policy, at some point, people are going to brush you aside and say, your way has achieved nothing. We're going to do it our own way. I have long hoped that the Europeans would do that and say, American sanctions, forget it. We're going to invest in Iran. We're going to transform the society from within. It may take 15 years, but America has had 30 years and totally blown it. That's what I've long browbeat Europeans into doing. I'm saying, if you're not confident in America's policy and you have all the connections in Iran and can do all the oil and gas there, why don't you just go do it? But they're afraid. Turkey is not afraid. Erdogan is not afraid. And so he stepped up and he said, I'm going to quintuple trade with Iran. I'm going to engage with Iran. I'm going to cut some deal with them on nuclear enrichment and so forth. It may or may not have gone anywhere. But the fact that more effort has been put into the reactions and denouncing Turkish diplomatic adventurism rather than supporting their shaking things up is really a reflects very poorly on the U.S. And now there is Egypt. And the fact is that, you know, the smart money is on pushing for a Turkish model for Egypt, one in which gradually, by empowering civil society, political parties, and so on, you train and raise and give confidence to a new secular and democratic elite in Egypt that gradually pushes the military aside. And that's exactly what happened in Turkey with great success. It's an organic process, but it requires a commitment to democracy. Now, if you're going to preemptively shoot democracy in the foot by saying, oh, we wanted democracy except when the Muslim Brotherhood was a party, that's not really going to work. You're either for democracy or you're against it. Right now, I'm not so sure.
Talk about what you write about in the book. A world of, as you call them, city-states, a lot of not isolation, but smaller configurations, some of them private, some of them public, some of them indefinable, making a new world. Three examples of the way Dubai, for example, is making a new world.
Dubai is a good example of a global entrepot, a city that is centrally geographically located under the financial guidance, tutelage of wealthier, oil-rich cousin, and is making, it's really put the Arab world on the map again in a lot of significant ways based on its investments in infrastructure, size of its economy, volume of tourism, hundreds of nationalities of people living in Dubai. They basically are trying to innovate a very interesting model, not of citizenship for all of these nationalities, but stakeholdership. Hmm. The idea that so many Europeans and Americans have actually put down roots in Dubai and want to live there for the rest of their lives and retire there and buy property there because of the low tax situation and the good weather, British schools, and all of these kinds of things.
You're not going to Dubai on us, are you, Parag?
No, but it's remarkable, though, that amidst all of the unrest that's happening around the Arab world, a couple of these Gulf statelets that have been focusing on investing infrastructure, creating some educational system, really reforming themselves. Of course, they remain monarchies, and they always will be, so get used to it. But we're seeing them actually build some kind of a non-strictly economically, you know, exploitative hierarchical society that's purely feudal. Instead, you have a cosmopolitan monarchy. I mean, how else to describe the United Arab Emirates but a cosmopolitan monarchy? A place that trades in all directions, does business with everyone as a wealthy and increasingly educated population that's investing in infrastructure, investing in its people. it's not going to turn into a Western-style democracy in the same way that China isn't going to. We shouldn't give their system any less respect just because it doesn't have nuclear weapons and a billion people and the Communist Party legacy. The fact is there are a plurality of systems out there. We still have monarchies in Europe. Obviously, they stand over parliamentary democracies. But we will see various forms of stakeholdership, as I'm calling it, emerge in order to maintain stability and improve the quality of life for the very diverse populations that live in the Persian Gulf region. And I see, obviously, looking at what's happening in Bahrain, obviously, you know, those that are purely autocratic and suppressive of majority populations, clearly they're going to fall. I'm never going to rush to their defense. But I see change happening in a lot of interesting ways in some of the other states that are, for the first time, not wasting every penny that comes in of oil, spending it on either weapons or Swiss bank accounts. They're making some domestic investments, and we should be encouraging it and see where it leads. We don't know where it's going to lead. I don't think you can graft the British parliamentary system onto the United Arab Emirates. You can try, and maybe you'll get there in several decades, but I'm more interested in the next couple of years and what initial steps we take.
Two other examples of non-states that might as well be nations for the power and the innovation and the influence they've found in a new world.
Well, let me just dispute the assumption in the question, which is the might as well be nations, because we still accord this privilege status, intellectually or otherwise, to the nation, the state, the territorial, that bounded geographic unit, as if and when a terrorist group or a company really does become as important as a state, it would become a state. That's not true at all. We are in a transnational, trans-territorial sort of space globally, in which I think that Royal Dutch Shell is perfectly happy not being a state as such. It has a global footprint and global operations. The Gates Foundation does not have to be a state to influence policies of hundreds of countries when it comes to public health. George Soros calls himself very proudly a stateless statesman because of the diplomacy that he conducts everywhere on behalf of the causes that he holds dear. So to me, the idea that something is becoming like a state is a linear projection, a teleological assumption that more power means becoming more like a state. That's not what the new Middle Ages, as I'm calling it, is really going to look like. Religious groups and religious actors, even those in the world of Islam who want a global caliphate, are really thinking much more about spreading that geography and community of belief more than they're thinking about what straight line borders are they going to put down on a map. So I think we have to be very imaginative about what forms of identity and power are going to shape the 21st century and focus ever less on just who is a state and who is not a state.
I stand corrected. And I still want two examples of your kind of players in this new world.
Well, I mentioned a whole bunch, I guess, just now, but we can hone in on, let's take the Gates Foundation, right, as an influential player. We tend to think in this, diplomatically, we think of this hierarchical system of states and their intergovernmental organizations. But what if I told you that the World Health Organization, which is the intergovernmental agency tasked with managing global public health issues, got 40% of its annual budget from the Gates Foundation? So just so that it's perfectly clear, an NGO is funding that supposed superstructure of international diplomacy. It's not being propped up by states. It's being propped up by one man's foundation. So we need to understand that in the hierarchy of things in the world, we need to think functionally and not legally. To think legally means to say the state supersedes all else. To think functionally means to recognize that who has power depends on where and over what. And Bill, the Gates Foundation has the power over public health in much of, for good or for ill. The state is also something that operates for good or for ill. When people say we can fix the world's problems by strengthening its states, and I say, well, why don't you get started? Because the entire post-colonial world is falling apart. All 120 of those countries, until they achieve sovereign, competent, respectable, non-corrupt statehood, you know, I'll meet you at the finish line. But I'm not working towards that world because I don't think it exists. I don't think it ever will exist. I'm working towards a world where functional challenges are solved by any players who have the resources available to address them. And so to me, if that is the clean technology company that can spread its emissions reducing wares in industrializing countries, so be it. I'm not going to wait for a climate treaty. I'm going to support that company. And if I want to push for human rights in the Middle East or in China, I'm going to back Google and I'm going to back Human Rights Watch and I'm going to back Amnesty International. And you can go ahead and sit in the Human Rights Committee in Geneva at the United Nations if you want to, and you tell me who's going to make more progress. And let's take it issue by issue by issue, and let's have a race to see who's going to deliver schools and health clinics in Afghanistan. Is it going to be the Afghan health ministry and the Afghan educational ministry that still don't exist because we've been in there a decade and achieved absolutely nothing in terms of the bureaucracy? Or is it going to be Save the Children and Oxfam and CARE? And no, they're not there just so that they can make their shiny, glossy brochures and raise money. They have plenty of money. They're doing everything that you would wish that our government agencies did and our international organizations did that we pay them to do with our taxpayer money. They're doing it better, they're doing it cheaper, and they're doing it faster. And what is more, they're not weakening local capacity. They're the only ones who train locals to do those jobs. They're the only ones who train locals. The international organizations pay so much that they steal the locals away from the jobs that they would be doing. So I'll take 1,000 Greg Mortensons over $1,000 to an aid agency any day of the week.
I love your reference to the post-colonial world, and we do. Egypt, for example, I mean, we realize this is going, this goes back to the British Empire. We kind of inherited it without quite talking about it or noticing. Who's going to teach us that we live in a post-colonial world in which we finally have to take a fresh look at the people themselves as people? Or are they going to teach us?
They're going to teach us. And this is where this book actually ends, with the line that says, diplomats of the world may have convinced themselves that by expanding the Security Council and having a somewhat more efficient governmental architecture, they're going to be able to meet the needs of the world's indigenous people, the rebelling workers, the South Asian guest laborers in the Persian Gulf, and the Naxalite movements of India. But governments are not going to meet those people's needs. They're going to be ignored, or they're going to be overthrown in revolt. And I think Egypt is just the first of many kinds of revolt that I indicated in precisely that paragraph of this book, because impatience is running very high. Impatience has become a virtue instead of patience.
Amen.
And I celebrate that 100%. I am not waiting for a global environment organization to be founded in New York to supposedly solve the world's environmental problems. I am not waiting for the World Bank to set up a vulnerability fund to reach and provide a lifeline to the world's poor. I'm going to support microcredit organizations that do that every single day. I'm going to capitalize them. That's what I want other people to do as well. I say very cruelly and crudely in this book that every economist from a third world country sitting in the World Bank in Washington should be sent home armed with a shovel, because they're not providing any insight into macro or microeconomic management for 45 African countries that need it when they're sitting in Washington. Anyone can go on the internet and download a recipe for how you restructure an economy. You either go to the country and you help them do it, or you don't waste our money on a cushy house in downtown D.C.
If we get time for one more short list of three, people out there in the world, and I love to chase them down myself, but who, either in describing it or in acting in it, seem to understand this new place.
I want to give shout-outs to a couple of these people. I want to first give a shout-out to Cameron Sinclair, who founded Architecture for Humanity. Cameron Sinclair doesn't go in with a big bulldozer and contractors from Bechtel to rebuild areas that have been destroyed by natural disasters. What Architecture for Humanity does is go into Haiti and hire locals, use only local materials, and use local architectural designs to rebuild communities one by one. It costs very little, and it lasts a lifetime. And they do it on the cheap. They partner with companies, they partner with other NGOs, they partner with governments. They practice what I call mega diplomacy. Public-private relationships that are efficient and get things done with locals in the lead. So that's shout-out number one.
Thank you.
Shout-out number two is to Sultan Al-Qasimi. Sultan Al-Qasimi is a columnist for The National, the newspaper in Abu Dhabi, who's an Emirati, very young guy, who writes these incredibly emotive and powerful columns. He is the living embodiment of young Al Jazeera. You know, he has no connection to Al Jazeera, but everything that Al Jazeera represents, which is an equal opportunity taking to task of corruption, whether it is Western or whether it is Arab. Remember, who are the first ones that Iraqi and Egyptian governments attack and shut down? It's their fellow Arabs from Al Jazeera. Sultan Al-Qasimi writes fiery columns that really go into the nitty-gritty of how to fix the broken systems across the Arab world, and he takes absolutely no prisoners. And he deserves to be read by everyone who instead is reading the New York Times and the columnists there on a daily basis.
Thank you.
So he's shout out number two, and you should follow him on Twitter, everyone out there.
We're on the case.
I'm going to give my third shout out to Vikram Akula, the founder of SKS Microcredit in India, who's been under fire, under attack, because his organization suffered a scandal recently in an eastern Indian state, and the government of that state shut down his operations, rolled up some of the banks. Shame on the banks. His organization may have made mistakes in how they report and how they collect and interest rates accruing and so forth to their customers. But shame on governments, shame on the naysayers who have tried to throw the baby out with the bathwater and pretend that they have done anything for the poor people of India or anywhere else in the world by not supporting microcredit the way they should have. Microcredit is the global revolution that did not come down-handed from some edict from the UN or the US or the World Bank. It's an organic grassroots revolution in how people go about financing their basic livelihoods. And to denounce it because of one scandal is a great shame. And SKS Microcredit and Grameen and all of the others that are now operating in every country in the world, including right here in the United States of America, because we need it too, deserve our support, every penny of it.
Parag Khanna, I am so glad you're out there. I'm so glad I read How to Run the World. I'm so glad you gave us this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.